You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes.
On Halloween night in 1992, a live television broadcast set out to investigate the haunting of a modern family home. Viewers tuning in observed more than they bargained for when paranormal activity invaded the familiar BBC One studios, literally traveling through the airwaves from the haunted house under investigation. The BBC switchboard was flooded with calls from an estimated 1 million viewers who believed that what they were witnessing was authentic investigative journalism and not a staged telefilm. Written by Welsh screenwriter and novelist Stephen Volk and directed by Leslie Manning, Ghostwatch ushered in a new era of reality TV and mockumentaries that blurred the lines between reality and fiction. Ghostwatch often draws comparisons to Orson Welles' 1938 The War of the Worlds radio broadcast for its impact and cultural legacy. Ghostwatch's influence continues to haunt us today through a myriad of found footage horror, ghost hunting programs, mockumentaries, as well as direct tributes and documentaries dedicated to the original telefilm. Today, we are joined by guest and author Vajra Chandrasekera to discuss Ghostwatch.
Vajra Chandrasekera is a Sri Lankan author known for his work in fantasy and science fiction. He was born and raised in Colombo. His first novel, The Saint of Bright Doors, won the Nebula Award for Best Novel of 2023. In 2024, he published his second novel, Rexfall.
Welcome, Vajra Chandrasekera, to After Images podcast. We are delighted to have you here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
And we are looking forward to discussing Ghostwatch with you, the 1992 television program. Could you begin by maybe letting us know why you chose Ghostwatch and what it means to you?
I actually did not see Ghostwatch when it first aired because I grew up in Sri Lanka. It obviously did not air on TV here. I saw it after it came out on DVD sometime in the 2000s. And I've always been fascinated by both its innovations and its interest in diegetic levels in storytelling, the way it doesn't just break the fourth wall, but kind of like pushes it over explosively in the, which it's, it, see, these are both techniques and themes in a way that I have explored a lot in my own work. And I think Ghostwatch is clearly one of the influences, though I wouldn't claim it as a direct influence because I write more towards the, you know, the fantasy or science fiction side than horror per se. But I've always been very impressed by how minimalist, in a way, the this film has seemed and how much it did with seemingly so little. So that's why I picked this one, because I wanted to pick something classic, you know, for the podcast. It was either this or Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it being the anniversary year and all. But I figured this one actually appeals to me more, even though I love both of those films, because specifically of its layered diegetic structure, which is the part of it that really sort of speaks to my interest in fiction.
And I was wondering, too, if perhaps also the importance of ghosts might not be something that is important to you. I had the feeling that ghosts and hauntings are a recurring theme in your fiction, aren't they?
Yes, very much so, yes. It's the aspect of horror that I think like shows up most commonly in most of my work, where there are, it's fairly common to have some kind of thread of haunting, not necessarily in a classical form, but something, usually for me, in the context of the memory of great crimes or atrocities that persist in later eras, which is obviously of interest to me because of the war and the genocide at the end of the war in 2009. So these are themes that have been present in my fiction since I began writing. And Ghostwatch has, I think, a more conventional take on haunting in that sense. but at least at the level of the, you know, the most basic story in the movie. But it also has, I think, a great deal to say about how different kinds of narrative are haunting each other, which is, in that sense, that is, I think, the very same kind of haunting that I like to write about. So it's...
Mm-hmm. And Ghostwatch itself is still haunting us, isn't it, even though it's been 30 years?
Yes, very much so. It's actually quite strange if you think about it, because part of the the power of the film came from, you know, the now infamous fact that it was mistaken for real by a lot of people during the live broadcast. But for me and a lot of other people who came later, we never saw the live broadcast. So we encountered it as this film that was already iconic, explicitly as a horror film. And still somehow it has that power, partly because of its history of the broadcast and everything that happened there. But also, I think, because of its place in history in a different sense, in the sense of like filmic history, like these various technical and narrative innovations that went on to become so popular to the point of oversaturation in the decades to come. And many of those things, I feel, I mean, I'm not a film history expert or anything, but I feel a lot of these things started with or became popular after the kind of the phenomenal reception that Ghostwatch got in the 90s. For example, I saw Blair Witch before I saw Ghostwatch, but the chronology of it makes sense to me, having seen that and other films that used similar methods. I think that there's a very real sense in which Ghostwatch, as a horror movie, not as a documentary, not as a live broadcast, but as a horror film, has a kind of very vital haunting presence in horror film today.
And I think that, like the best sorts of hauntings, Ghostwatch has multiple layers of hauntings. On one hand, on the surface level, there is the haunting of this home that we're experiencing as viewers that sort of imitates the Enfield poltergeist case. And there's this very literal, you know, malevolent, ghostly presence. And at the same time, like the best of horror and other genre fictions, we really dive deep into past hauntings in terms of revisiting this ghost who has been referred to as Pipes in a Victorian context. You know, one caller says that this may have been a Victorian baby hunter who is in the sort of baby trade. And then we also get the more recent history of perhaps a pedophile who has been active in the area, who lived in the house. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that idea of layering, because it's something that I also find in your writing, in terms of this kind of layers of family history, of societal history, and where they intersect.
Yeah, I think the Enfield poltergeist is, I think, clearly something that the filmmakers were directly referencing, right? Because that was also, I believe, in the late 70s, so not too long before the film, and also featuring a single mother, and I think there were more kids in that case, but there were two daughters for sure, and possibly other children. And also, I think, a council house, which is also very, the sort of the class symbolism of this, is very one of the many, many things that made Ghostwatch feel, which it's actually funny now, because when you look back at it now, it feels like, it feels not dated exactly, it feels like a time capsule of the 90s, right? But at the time, even in the early 2000s, but especially in the 90s, it must have felt so contemporary. So everything from the housing to the decor to the concerns of the other neighborhood residents in this estate. And I think at the very beginning of the film, Michael Parkinson says something, when he's introducing the house, he says something like, no, there are no Gothic towers. This is not like a, it's not like a haunted castle, like the haunted castles of the aristocracy. This is not the castle of Otranto, which is very much like the haunted castles of the aristocracy. This is the haunting of a very kind of lower middle class home, which is in public housing, which is everything that is recognizable and familiar, and the posters the kids have in the bedroom, the this is it's very contemporary, very grounded, very ordinary. So applying all this the sort of gothic horror kind of haunting to this ordinary framing on film, and also yet presenting it as real in multiple ways, not just with the I think there were considerable lengths have clearly been gone to achieve this effect of verisimilitude, which is which actually, I don't know how technically difficult this was at the time. I'm assuming it must have been quite difficult. The appearance of a live broadcast, which was not a live broadcast, with multiple people with call-ins, with like pre-recorded video and people interacting with clearly pre-recorded video. So there's the I think the layering in Ghostwatch is there's technical layering as well as the format of the film itself is layered in a way that mirrors the haunting, right? Mother Seddon and I've forgotten his name, Pipes' his real name, Tunstall. I want to say Tunstall. I think it's Tunstall. The way the various hauntings are layered in a way that I think is meant to evoke both the history of this idea that that every any particular place is haunted by more than is haunted by history, which contains more than one scene of violence or atrocity or something that could leave a mark in the sense of haunting, but also from all the calls that come in from different parts of England during the course of the film, which indicate that not only is Pipes' influence spreading, but also that there is this kind of culture, this kind of cultural strata of hauntings that is everywhere, right? This is like one of the reasons that the great seance happens is because it's not just this one particular place that is the most haunted house in all of Britain, which is how it's built, I think, at some point in the early part of the documentary, but that the whole country is haunted in a very similar way, and that many people are having similar experiences, some of which are maybe whether they're real or not is kind of besides the point. The point is that the fear is infectious, and the resonances are infectious to many people who are watching this show in the world of the story, in the world of the film. So I think that layer of cultural haunting is a big part of what Ghostwatch is tapping into. The idea that despite this modernity, despite this very 90s contemporary appearance, that there is a deep haunted culture that all of this is sitting on top of, right? So apart from being, I feel, a criticism of modern TV and its the way it's invasive and exploitative towards people who are clearly in distress, it's also, I think, a criticism of that very post-Thatcher 90s neoliberal culture, which is very technological, very technical, very modern, very rational, but also very shallow. It's floating on top of this giant historical ocean of violence and haunting. And yeah, that's to me, I think, what comes to mind most when you say layers in Ghostwatch.
And there's a very strong tension, I think, between the micro and the macro in this story. I mean, as you said, between the family in the house and Great Britain as a whole. And it's interesting to me how the United Kingdom is somehow portrayed as a family of sorts, too, with Parkinson playing a father of sorts as opposed
Yes,
to Pipes,
the
which.
patriarch, yes.
And I think that this tension between the two families is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And the I think like one of the things that was different for me watching Ghostwatch, that apart from Michael Parkinson, I didn't know who any of the other BBC the presenters were, like Sarah Green, and well, I knew who Craig Charles was because of Red Dwarf, But I did not know Mike Smith and Sarah Green, so that the familiarity, which was then estranged, that part of it didn't land for me. I found out about that later. Of course, like Michael Parkinson, I knew from his talk show, from clips of it. I can't say I ever watched it regularly, but I think like he's a huge part of this, not just in terms of anchoring the narrative as its chief commentator, but as you said, as the father figure, the patriarch, because he represents the voice of skepticism all the way through the end, right? He is, I mean, the whole frame story is very skeptical. Craig Charles is outright making fun of the haunted family to their face. But I think Michael Parkinson's corruption by the entity is central to the, it's the most like frightening or startling part of the film at the very end, when everything has kind of come undone and Parkinson himself is, and it's really that final shot is so effective because you can't see his eyes. It's cut off, like just it comes way too close to the camera and starts muttering tunstilisms.
Yeah, and it's the idea of losing control. I mean, there's this idea that the technology that is brought inside this house is going to be able to dissect it and to really be able to fight the chaos that is inside the house, but the chaos is stronger in the end.
Yeah, to pin it down, right? There's a long kind of introductory bit where they talk about how they have infrared cameras, they have all the sound equipment to pick up different frequencies, and in fact I think infrared cameras must have been quite novel in filmmaking at the time as well, especially that kind of mobile equipment. So it's very much this, oh, we have this under control. This is a very contained, it's so contained that it's kind of like a figure of fun, really, that when they're making fun of it. It's meant to be, it opens essentially as light entertainment, right? This is not meant to be, and this is probably why it was so effective as a live broadcast as well, because this is actually the kind of fun show you might watch on a Halloween night. It's like, oh, and I believe Ghostwatch predates the entire genre of TV ghost hunting, right?
Absolutely.
By probably most of a decade. I don't remember anything else in that form like cropping up until practically until the end of the 90s for sure. So, and I'm sure a lot of it was influenced or inspired by Ghostwatch in the first place. But the thing about like ghost hunting shows is that they're mostly incredibly boring because, well, nothing happens, right? Nothing ever happens. I read an it was an article I think somewhere, someone was commenting on Ghostwatch at due for one of the anniversaries. I came across it when I was googling up stuff for this episode, and this was someone who had watched the first half of Ghostwatch like live and then gone to bed because they thought, oh well, this is just going to be like boring, they're going to be up all night and nothing's going to happen. Because yeah, you can actually do that for the first half of the, like there are appearances from Pipes, but they're subtle and you don't really notice most of them. In fact, I believe Leslie Manning has said there were some absurdly high number of appearances from Pipes. I have never seen most of those. I've never caught more than like three or four myself.
Same. Sorry to interrupt, but this is actually something that I find very interesting because we are always talking about Ghostwatch in relationship to reality TV. But to me, there is also something, especially for the people who are watching it a second or a third time, about a game show, about, where's Waldo? I mean, it's not where's Waldo, but it's where's Pipe? I mean, and you're
Where's
trying to
Pipes?
find him. It's really interesting.
And the mere fact that you can have watched it like a half a dozen times and still not spotted all the appearances of Pipes that that are supposed to be there is amazing in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think rewatching it as a horror, oh, sorry, I interrupted
Oh,
you.
no, please.
No, I was just going to say that when you rewatch it as a horror film, you realize that one of the other things that are layered is the concept of audience, right? Because if the people in the haunted house are the players, then the first audience is in the film itself. That's Parkinson and Dr. Pascoe in the studio. And the second audience is the people who the 11 million or however many people watched the live broadcast in 1992. But then there's a third audience, which is everybody who came afterwards and is watching and rewatching this as this iconic horror film, and trying to parse how it works, what did it do, how does it influence horror. So that even the concept of audience is very specifically layered because this film had these very different receptions. So the events in the house, the haunted house, also have very different receptions. As you say, the game show reception is a completely different approach to the film.
And to come back to these ghost hunting type shows, I think it's really interesting what you said because we don't have this culmination in some really exciting event. It's such a like kind of drawn out, very different cadence in terms of the rhythm that those shows produce. And at the same time, in terms of aesthetics, I think that Ghostwatch is what really set the tone for them in terms of using these kind of their infrared cameras and thermal cameras and all of these different types of images that we see in Ghostwatch that then become the norm going forward. And I'm also thinking about the intersections of reality TV, which, where I was living at the time anyway, sort of came up in the early 90s as a major force and then went on to take on different forms. And I'm just curious because it's very interesting to discuss with people in different countries to know where you think this intersection of reality TV and also different kinds of supernatural programming, how does that sit, for example, in a Sri Lankan context for you? What's your experience of that model television?
I think for us, reality TV was very imitative. It came late. It came after, I think, we also basically have the equivalent of, American Idol or whatever, Britain's Got Talent, that sort of thing. Those kinds of shows started showing up, but a few years behind, quite a few years behind in some cases. But once it started going, obviously, there was a But I don't think we have, and this might just be my ignorance of modern Sri Lankan TV. I don't watch a lot of TV per se, films mostly, but not TV per se. Maybe we have survivor type shows now, but I'm not aware of any. So I think there were certain genres that appealed more in reality TV. So talent shows are very popular, but the Big Brother kind of thing, not so much, because I think perhaps the cultural norms work against it a little. You've got to have people like, you've got to have sort of this kind of sexually charged atmosphere, which probably would not fly so well in a relatively conservative country. And for the supernatural, I think part of the problem is that Sri Lanka like has a very different culture of the supernatural, right? We have our own sets of like things, different kinds of hauntings. And so, for example, our pop culture has a lot more interaction with very local kinds of hauntings. So for example, buried treasure, which is protected by a demon, that is a common trope in all like magical animals, magical snake comes out of the river, and this means something prophetic for the country, whatever. This sort of thing, you have that kind of thing a lot. Haunted houses, I think, are very we to me at least, it's a very European trope. So I don't think we have that quite so much. We do have, ironically, like the Gothic horror was wildly popular in Sri Lanka, always has been. So transplanted to a local setting, but like classic sort of like, are this colonial mansion now dilapidated, overlooked by its ghosts kind of thing. So a lot of early Sri Lankan English literature in particular was very much just transplanting 19th century Gothic horror into Sri Lankan settings. And it was also like, I think, a very common trope in Sri Lankan TV programs of the 80s and 90s. But apart from that, I think our hauntings generally take a different, we work with a different set of tropes. So you wouldn't quite get a show like a, I think a ghost hunting show would not quite work the same way. Like roadside ghosts are much more common, I think, as a trope than in a house, right? Like, I don't know if you know the Mohini story. It's like kind of the woman in white. It's a local variant of the woman in white, basically. We have that. It's very popular. And we have many like like people died in a car crash here, and now that crossroads is on that sort of thing. Yes, but I think it would be likelier to see exorcism rituals turned into pop culture than it would be to see, because they already practically are pop culture anyway. Because exorcism rituals are very loud and musical and colorful, and it's easy to turn that into pop culture. Whereas like haunted houses, not so much. I cannot really see like a local equivalent to something like Ghost Watch. So for me, I think there was that little bit of a translation. Like I said, like for example, not recognizing who Mike Swift was or who Sarah Green was. There's a cultural gap there. Even Parkinson, like I did not have the I recognized him as one of many old white guys who had talk shows, interview shows on various American and TV like shows. So, but I didn't have, I think, what must have been a much more personal, parasocial kind of relationship to the, and people talk like parasociality was invented by the internet, but it really wasn't, right? Because like in the 90s or the 80s, like people had exactly that kind of relationship with their newsreaders and their talk show hosts and their television personalities. And I'm sure like in other countries where the TV culture is older, it goes back even further, in the States, for example. And that, I think, parasocial relationship is exactly what they're playing with here by inverting it, right? Because there's this kind of BBC voice of rationality representing the culture as a whole, but also it's like it's that we are, you're speaking in like it's the received pronunciation of rationalism, right? Of rationality, like so when Michael Parkinson says, "Oh, there's nothing to panic, these sorts of things are very rare," you're expected to take that at face value, and when the film subverts that, it's that much more effective. So it's that part of it is less effective if you aren't like if you haven't been taught from childhood to have that relationship with Michael Parkinson personally. But you can still recognize him as an archetype of that sort of person, even if you don't know his work particularly well. I think, judging from what I have read, Sarah Green was a children's show presenter. So this must have been even more of a punch as a girl, especially for any kids who were watching that night.
And I've read that her on-screen husband really was her husband, because for Frank and myself, we also don't have those references of Michael Parkinson, for example. We didn't grow up watching that. And it's for that reason that, I mean, as you said, it still transmits in a way. He's got that certain, vocal elocution where that he's a real anchor man, that he's got that kind of authoritarian, well, voice of reason, as you said. And so that still comes across. But yes, it, I suppose, is slightly less effective for those of us who aren't familiar with those figures who come into the homes of people. And I think that that was really underscored for me while watching the documentary about the making of Ghost Watch, because there's a young woman who watched Ghost Watch as a child who's interviewed in the film, and she says, from the documentary, I learned that Parkinson must have this nickname, Parky, and she says, Parky wouldn't lie to us. That was her feeling as a child.
But this is very interesting because in the same documentary, they are saying that part of the outburst that accompanied the screening of Ghost Watch was possibly based on the breach of trust between the BBC on the one hand and the audience on the other. That is, that all of a sudden, all references were lost to the audience, that they felt that they had been abandoned and somehow started to panic, questioning the very nature of reality. And I think this is so interesting in relationship with this show, the nature of the reality that it is depicting. Is it the real reality? Is it the reality of the medium? What is your take on this, about the ontological aspect of Ghost Watch?
I think it's very much, it's actually amazing that it got made and aired in the way it did, I think, because I think it is very much a critique of the BBC and that kind of television culture, not just the BBC, but the television culture in general. And I think to that end, I think it goes to great lengths, first to build that kind of trust. That it will then betray for maximum effect, but also to go as far as possible to entangle the audience to make them feel implicated in what is happening. Like this is a live event, you are participating, you are part of this culture, this event, this is all really happening. Because it like from the call-in numbers to the actual calls to the reassurances that Michael Parkinson gives throughout, like the which are reassurances that you realize afterwards are like are there to build that trust that you can break it. But the seemingly interactive nature of this pre-recorded broadcast and I read somewhere, I think, that they weren't even sure if this is going to air on Halloween. That was like a touch or go, whether like it would actually air on the correct date, but it did. So if it hadn't, presumably people would have panicked less. It would have been like easier to like read it. But yeah, I think one of the things that Ghostwatch does really, really well in at every level is to very convincingly present a show that is being made, right? They're very careful to not just to make the show, like the fundamental the film is about like a group of people who are making a show, right? You have the cameraman, your studio, the sound people, and so forth. So just the number of times you can see the mic. You can see the cameraman moving around. You're conscious of the camera movements. In fact, you're even conscious of when the camera switch from the handheld camera to the fixed cameras in the house, because that gives you this kind of bird's eye view. And it's very, very rarely that they do a dramatic zoom in. And they do a few times, and I think that was like they couldn't like avoid like the kind of dramatic zoom in that makes it feel more drama like than a documentary. But I think I told you when we first started talking about this and why I wanted to talk about Ghostwatch is I said I watched Late Night with the Devil recently, and I didn't like it. And it reminded me of Ghostwatch done badly, basically. One of the reasons I thought that, I think, in hindsight, now after rewatching Ghostwatch, this is clear to me also, is that Late Night with the Devil, being like a modern, very slick, very kind of casual, shallow film, it does this thing where it tries to delve into the backstory of the presenter, the Parkinson-like equivalent character. Who is a great actor, who does a great job with the material, but the material is not very good, I think. Because they do this thing where they're trying to show in when they're showing behind the scenes footage, they switch to black and white and they show us conversations that would never have been recorded, right? Which completely breaks any sense of credibility or reality. Like, why would this be on tape? And if it were on tape, why would it be in black and white and from these angles and so forth? Ghostwatch is very, very precise with this kind of thing. Like if towards the end, when you can only see part of Parkinson's face, that is literally because the cameraman has abandoned the camera, and the you can actually see him wandering around asking which camera is live. Or earlier, when when we cut back to the studio unexpectedly, and then there's somebody checking the mic or something, and Parkinson's like, no, clear the set, we're on air. And then there's another point where Craig Charles mutters something about the BBC, like as if he were unaware that he were on air at that moment. These little mistakes, this is very clearly intentional, like from the point of view of Stephen Wilk and the actual filmmakers, these intentional mistakes made by the fictional filmmakers are there to remind us that this is a made thing, right? That it's being presented to you. And I think one of the things that device is doing is try to by bearing the artificiality of the show within the show Ghost Watch on BBC, which does not exist, but of that the how it's artificial, the errors and the kind of the hubris of it, and the technical mishaps that will happen in any kind of live production where something unexpected happens. By showing us those things, it is constantly reminding us that there's the haunting story, and then there's the studio story. And both of those have similar kind of unveilings to do. Like in the house, it's about unveiling the ghost, but in the studio, it's about unveiling television itself, like as an exploitative medium, as an invasive medium, the way, you shove a camera in somebody's face while they're crying and ask how did it feel? It is the culture that this, I think that is what the ghost in Ghost Watch is, as much the television as Tunstall.
Yeah, it's the ghost in the machine,
There's the ghost in the machine.
and once
Who is
again,
under that? And as if to drive it home, they literally put the ghost in the machine, in the studio, just in case you missed it.
And once again, I think that the name itself, pipes, functions so well. I mean, the television is the pipe that is going directly into your house. And I think this is very Lynchian too. I mean, this is very much what David Lynch is doing in his films. He's obsessed with electricity, with television, and all these elements coming from the outside, invading the private space. The interactivity is fascinating in Ghost Watch because, of course, television is usually something that is only going one way, but here it goes both ways because there are all those elements about people calling, about a real interactivity between the two levels of the narration, and they are really good about sticking, as you say, to this point of view that they've chosen in the beginning, in this style of telling it as if this was a live show the whole time, and not breaching the trust with the audience by adding elements that would have been pre-recorded about thoughts or different colors. So, I mean, I think that is very true to its source material.
I like the pipes thing, well, that you said, especially because it evokes, I think, the internet is a series of pipes. I don't remember who said that. It was some politician somewhere. And I think that happened a good 10 years after Ghost Watch. But that language, it does in fact date back to television, and to probably even older. Like, I don't know if like people talked about the radio that way, but the idea of like something being of connectivity, right? And of course the whole knocking on the pipes thing.
And I
But
think
I
that
was also thinking maybe the piper, I don't know if that was intentional, a spirit that gathers children.
That's very interesting.
And I wonder if we might jump off here to talk about children, because I do think that this whole idea of staging and the way that we choose to present is also something that evokes questions of child abuse and the recomposition of the family that was much discussed at that time, at least in the West, and this idea of latchkey children who grew up with only one parent and were perhaps, left to their own devices, but also the idea of keeping up appearances. It's a time, I think, in history where we really start to look very consciously at issues of child abuse and incest, etc. And these really come to the fore with certain educational programs that were established, telephone hotline numbers that members of the family could call should there be an issue that was identified within the family. And they hint very much at this in Ghost Watch, don't they, with these certain moments where we call into question the veracity of Susan's story when we see her knocking on the pipes and she claims that it's because she wants to share this story. But then, of course, there are the scratches on the face that appear and all of this. And then we learn that pipes could potentially have been one of the pedophiles who lived in this house. So I'm just curious, once again, for you, what do you think about this representation of children who are so central to this story?
Yeah, I think the film itself, through the voice of Dr. Pascoe, has a running commentary on children and especially young girls in this kind of haunting. She says at one point, I think she thought it was the older daughter because she was pubescent, and the there's this association of poltergeist activity with girls that age as they grow, as they recognize themselves as sexual beings, or receive that kind of attention from adults, and find themselves troubled by their self-perceptions as well as how the world perceives them. But also, I think like the entire Susan scene is a callback to The Exorcist, I think, to say that is the kind of story we are referencing here. But is it fake? The part where Susan is knocking on the pipe is actually my favorite bit because it's so because Dr. Pascoe looks so upset afterwards. She looks so disappointed, but at the same time, she's being besieged on both sides, first by Michael Parkinson as the host, and then by the outside expert, the guy from New York with the gigantic shoulder pads. Silvestri, who shows up from New York. I don't think he was actually like, but yeah, he's the external expert who is the voice of extreme, and extreme, I think, for this space, intentionally, quote unquote, American reason, right? This is the representing like the I think the size of his shoulder pads probably also represents something because it's very, I don't know, maybe it passed as normal back then. It was 1992. But I was like, it's like every time I see him, his shoulders are wider. Anyway, he represents the most, if Parkinson's voice of skepticism is kind of genteel, kind of sneer, but it's at least it's like indulgent, whereas Silvestri is harsh and critical. And so Pascoe is getting it from both sides because Susan has just punctured this entire narrative of haunting. And I think Pascoe says something like, maybe the children felt, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but maybe the children felt obliged to perform with all this pressure. And I think that is another place where this, as you said, the relationship of children to this kind of story comes in because it's reminiscent of the fake fairy photos, the Cottingley fairies, children who are performing in some way and attempting to interact with this adult world in what they think is the way that the adult world wants them to do, right? So even Susan actually says this. She starts screaming, "We gave you what you wanted," something like that. So because she thinks that the attention, this gratifying attention from this older, cool older woman who is a scientist and respected and all these things that that she probably presumably aspires to, all of that comes because of the haunting. So if the haunting is not presenting itself, she feels compelled to create a haunting on her own. So in the world of the story, the haunting is real. So this is not actually like pure like invention on Susan's part, but there is a degree of invention at the same time. So, and I think the Ghost Watch also I think skewers Pascoe's point about the pubescent girlhood because it turns out that Kim is just as haunted as Susan, right? Because she pipes gets her to blind her. stuffed toy, which is one of the more sort of oddly more startling moments in this film. It's like the scratches on the face, I'm sure, were very startling, like on live TV. But knowing it's a horror film, somehow the blinding of the bunny rabbit is more startling to me, because that is, it feels like an unnatural thing for a child to do. Whereas scratches are just makeup. I mean, you're watching a horror film, you understand it, but like, yeah, no, this took a twist kind of thing. Yeah, I think like it's also telling that at the end they keep trying to get the kids to leave the haunted house, but the kids won't go for whatever reason. And I think that the concern for the children, the adults keep, like, when the adults realize something is going wrong, they keep trying to get the children out of the house. The children keep going back into the house and placing themselves in danger, and also exacerbating the haunting and the pace and the intensity of the events. So there's very much, I think, clearly something going on here, as the children, as the catalyst, as the kind of the focal point of all this energy. And as you say, it is because I think of the innocence and the vulnerability of children is in fact literally the energy that drives the anxiety of the audience, and of like culture in general. Like so many social panics derive like from quote unquote worrying about the children, right? Like mostly misplaced worries that then lead to greater social problems. But from the satanic panic to the trans panic or whatever, like all of this is like ways for adults to project their prejudices and their terrors on children who just want to live their lives. But that the use of children as focal points, as objects of this to invest energy in, I think that is what the film is demonstrating by the fact that the children are impossible to extricate from the haunted premises.
I thought it was very interesting what you said about the fairy photos from the 19th century in relationship with what they call the glory hole, which is this place
Yes.
under the staircase, which was used by the father as a dark room, as a
Yes.
place where pictures were being developed. So, and which is also traditionally, at least since Harry Potter, the place where children go and can sometimes hide. I think that there is something very interesting about this connection between the children, the glory hole as a space for pictures and a hiding spot, and also the center of the haunting. This is the place where the newscaster gets us. Disappears
Disappears.
at the end of the film. Can you tell us about what you think about the symbolism of this place and what it might mean in
Well,
relation?
first of all, I found it nearly impossible to not laugh at the glory hole. Apparently, this was at some point in regional British usage, glory hole meant something else. Like I had to look it up, like a cupboard where you stored miscellaneous objects, and not what I think everyone in the world would now consider to be a glory hole. They keep saying glory hole, which is, you're like, please stop saying glory hole. But yes, so the glory hole. It's also the place where I think Tunstall is supposed to have killed himself, which is why he appears. I think one of the clearest appearances of, and actually Pipes is a very unusual horror movie villain in this sense, because he doesn't actually properly appear at all, right? Ever. Like every conventional horror movie, the monster, towards the end at least, like will appear in all its terrible well, glory. I think the clearest glimpse we get of Pipes is when the reporter opens the door and it shuts again, but behind the you get this like glimpse of Pipes, and he looks more solid and more present behind the door than he does in any of his other appearances, because I think most of his other appearances is either kind of like an effect of the shadow, or seen in glass or through glass. So this is like our first and only, I mean, I might be wrong about that, but like glimpse of him, like in, no, that's not right, because he also appears in the crowd outside at one point when Craig Charles is leading the medium. So that is also like a direct, like view. So just for a second kind of thing. But yeah, this is the first kind of confrontational upfront view of the under the stairs cupboard. I didn't make the Harry Potter connection. I kind of like excised Harry Potter from my mind after, you know, J.K. Rowling became a Turk and generally. So I no longer like, those associations don't come to me. But yeah, below, I would have, I associate the term below stairs with kind of like this Downton Abbey kind of below stairs, meaning, you know, the servant class of the aristocracy. So I wouldn't have made that connection either. But yeah, the dark room, that is interesting because I didn't really think about that. But as a place of revelation, as it were, where previously unseen, invisible things are made to manifest, kind of thing. So in that sense, yes, though I actually don't remember what happened to the husband. Has he died or are they just separated?
Think they're
The
separated. I remember well.
separate, right. Yeah.
It's
Yes,
kind of.
presumably he was never haunted by pipes in his dark room. No. Yeah, no. So I didn't like particularly make that connection to anything like well, the cupboard, except I think for the most part, like just this idea that like many houses, many like when you're a kid growing up, there are often like places in your house which are scarier than others, right? Like and storerooms, locked away spaces, dark cupboards, things that are not often opened up and cleared out, tend to be the kind of place in a house which is most frightening. So for me, I read it simply as that, like in this house, which is like a it's a nice house. It's cluttered in the way that it would be with a single parent and two kids. And it's a council house, so presumably like it's smaller than they need. But all the other spaces we see in the house are very lived in, right? Only the glory hole is locked up and boarded up. But even if it wasn't boarded up, it would be kind of this shut away space for forgotten things, right? Like it's supposed to be a cupboard where you dump your stuff for storage when you don't have a purpose for it anymore, which is I think also dovetails with the you know the haunting and the fact that Tunstall went in there to kill himself in the first place because his whole story, his death, as we are told via the caller, is a story of abandonment, right, of being thrown away. And then even after he dies, he's thrown away. He's like he's left to rot and to be eaten by his cats, which I think is what has happened. So I think the association of the glory hole in that sense as a place where unwanted things end up in this house, in this otherwise cozy domestic space, there's one contained area, which is just the part that you don't want, the part that doesn't belong in the cozy domesticity. So in that sense, I think it makes sense that this is the focus of the fear and the it's kind of like an extrusion of the you know the outside world upon this very like tightly knit family. Right, like the daughters and the mother are clearly very close, and the kids are very young, so you see them, you know, like playing games and drawing pictures and all this. It's a very sort of domestic, enclosed environment. I think the absence of the father and his photography, his implied photography habit, might also be telling here because I don't remember if there were pictures of the kids around the house, like photos.
I don't recall. What I do remember is that in the news studio they had
There
photos.
was a gigantic, like, yeah, blown up poster of the two kids, yeah, all dressed up and with their hair done and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I assume that had been done by the BBC, like in the story, because they had been working on this for so long. Yeah, but I thought this is also one of the reasons that the kids are so attached to the parapsychologist, is because she's been working them with them for over a year, and with the absence of their father, she's like the only other like adult presence in their life. So they want to impress her and to please her, hence the the performance of the fake pipes that Susan attempts to put together.
But that space under the staircase is very much a black hole, like I would say, it's a space of repression that is associated with the father, with the absence of the father, and that drags everything into this pot, just like a black hole would stars in the universe. I mean, there is something very, there's a lot of energy there, I think, isn't there? Dark
And I
energy.
think like yeah, the absence of the father is a good way to put it, because they don't really talk very much about the absent father, but maybe that is precisely because that of that kind of repressed energy, which is going directly towards that space that used to be his and central to his own interests, which is not part of the domestic life. And Tunstall himself is like, as far as gender dynamics goes, Tunstall is a very ambiguous figure in his own right. Whether he's possessed by Mother Seddons or simply inspired by Mother Seddons, or but he wears a dress. He claims that there is a woman inside his body. So there's all this. All of that would be responded to very differently today, I think. And I'm not sure if some of this was not like. There was a tendency, I think, in 90s horror to lean on gender deviance as a Silence of the Lambs, for example, to lean on it as a, like a source of horror, like, oh, look at the scary
Yeah,
person
very.
who is not definitively male. I think there's something little more than that going on with Tunstall and Mother Seddon, because it's also like we were talking about the layering of ghosts, right? The layerings of hauntings. So Tunstall is embodying like in his very being, he's a ghost with another ghost inside him. Maybe that's one way to read it. So kind of, it's as if all the kind of the bile and the resentments and rage of like of these decades and centuries have kind of coalesced into this figure who is Pipes, who is neither Tunstall or Seddons, but kind of both. But in that sense, also, I think it's maybe about concentration, like how things are layered to the point where they collapse
I was thinking
from
that
the weight.
confusion, this idea of not being able to distinguish anymore the layers or the borders of genders, of spaces, of layers, that there
Of
is.
periods, even.
Yes. And once again, with the notion of the black hole where everything collapses somehow into a gravity well where everything is destroyed. That's what I was thinking about, this idea of confusion. I think it resonates with what you're saying.
We talk a lot about how much Ghost Watch influenced other cultural trends that would soon follow. But you did earlier on mention some of the Gothic references and how those have been transposed to a contemporary setting in 1992. And you also mentioned Dr. Pascoe briefly, and I wanted to come back to this character and, in particular, the relationship between the parapsychologist and the children. As we mentioned, there's the missing father, and she has a sort of almost family-like connection to them, having spent so much time with them. And I'm just throwing this out there. I haven't thought about it a lot, but somehow this reminded me of the relationship of the governess in The Turn of the Screw, or many other governesses actually in Gothic horror literature. And it reminded me that I believe that Stephen Volk, and Stephen Volk, if you're listening, please forgive me if I'm misrepresenting you, but I believe that one of his favorite films is an adaptation of The Turn of the Screw that he considered
Right.
discussing with us on the podcast. So I'm just thinking about The Turn of the Screw as a potential source or reference or inspiration for some of this family dynamic and questions of truth and representation and the kind of blurred lines that we find in Ghost Watch.
No, yeah, I mean that does sound right. To be fair, it's been a while since I last read The Turn of the Screw, and I don't
That's
remember
why I
in
am
detail
too.
enough to like draw direct like lines. But yeah, there is clearly a sense in which Blaine Pascoe has inserted herself into this family and in some ways confused their needs with her own. Like, for example, agreeing to this TV broadcast is clearly not in the interests of the family's mental health. But she went ahead with it anyway because I don't know, like exposing or like not exposing, but like being able to break this story, if that was possible, is a bigger deal to her than than upsetting the kids or whatever. So there's kind of there's I guess that's also it's not particularly unparental, this mixture of like of care and also using people. Using these small humans to for your own benefit, for your own ego, for your own whatever. I don't get the sense that the kids see her as more of a parent or more of a mother figure or anything than their own mother because they are clearly very attached to their mother, right? They call for her whenever they're freaking out. They talk to her like intimately whenever. And she's the one who's comforting them usually. Pascoe's usually at a bit of a distance, unless except like in the few scenes where the recorded scenes where you see Pascoe interacting with the kids directly on her own. So I don't think it's like a an in loco parentis situation. I'm not sure if the governess works exactly, but I'm not entirely sure like if it's kind of like a initiatory, like a magical kind of aspect to this relationship, which is what I kind of got from "We gave you what you wanted," quote unquote, from the elder daughter, is that like being a parapsychologist is kind of a fringe position, right? Kind of like being the village witch to like this 20th century Britain kind of thing. So think it's the not the power exactly because I don't, but the access to knowledge and to this greater world that at least one of the daughters, the elder one, seems to crave, whereas the younger one not so much maybe. But so even though she goes to her mother for comfort, she turns to Dr. Pascoe for to be initiated into this different kind of adulthood. I don't know, it's just a it's a incomplete thought, I guess. But that is the kind of relationship that I got from the film. Not an unquestioning acceptance. Not but yes, definitely to a like to she accepts this woman's authority, and her right to make these proclamations. Or these assertions about what is real and what isn't real, or how to deal with any of it. Yeah, and I think the callback to Gothic fiction at the beginning is very much to deny it, but at the same time, the tradition of Gothic fiction doesn't. One of the things that Ghostwatch is saying here is that like Gothic horror doesn't require a castle. It can happen in a council house. It can happen in your middle class home to people who are just like you, and you have all the other you have the the haunted domicile, you have the familial traumas. At one point, I believe the mother says something like, "We've tried to get them to move us to another house, but they haven't, or they won't, or whatever." So there's this kind of trappedness in this. So you're not trapped in a castle, but you're trapped in, public housing, and it's bureaucracy. So it's not your aristocratic inheritance that burdens you. It's the bureaucracy of this kind of corrupted welfare state where they don't believe that you're haunted and won't give you another house. And the hauntings are not from the same house, right? They are not necessarily the house. One of them is from the same house, possibly, or an earlier structure on the same building, the same location. But the older haunting, Mother Seddon's, is for definitely from, like, it's on the same plot of land, but not the same building. So it's about a haunted house that predates the house, as it were, right? So it's digging deeper into the ground, as it were, than like the traditional Gothic horror with a literal castle would necessarily, because those were tied to specific families or family dramas. Like Otranto is my favorite example for this reason. Lost my train of thought.
But they're talking about ley lines, I think, at one point. And I think this really resonates with what you're saying about the importance of the land itself.
Yeah, and that the way in which Pascoe references ley lines is actually hilarious, because she's like, "Well, we got a list of all the previous tenants of the house in this public housing system. Then we got all the people who've owned it back to the Doomsday Book, which is, I don't know, like centuries old, right? It's about the tenants of this, and then down to the ley line." So she's very seamlessly moving from modern tenancy to this kind of mythic sphere of like the telluric currents or whatever it is that this land is. And she's saying all this like seamlessly and in a list of former occupants of the land, of the property, of the space. So I find that seamlessness very interesting. The way you got to ley lines from tenants of this council house, that is fascinating. And the fact that it goes unremarked, like Parkinson doesn't question it. No one questions it. The caller questions it only to say, "Well, you didn't account for the illegal tenants."
But it's funny because with television landscape in a wider context, I think it's also a reference, a kind of shout out to some of the great sort of British horror television of the 70s, where ley lines are very much a recurring theme that came during this kind of period where we talk about kind of golden epic for history, or sorry, a golden historic era for horror television in the UK. And for me, it was something of this kind of greater metaphor for British television in general. I don't know, I've never asked Stephen Volk about this.
No, I think, yeah, it's very true. I think I don't know the TV in question, but I have to say that ley lines were extremely popular in fantasy, like fiction, of that, because there was an era in that kind of like the through the 60s through to the early 80s, maybe, when a lot of parapsychology stuff was imagery ideas was very popular in fantasy, in and in science fiction for that matter, right? Like telepathy, ley lines were treated, I think, in many cases as more science fictional than fantasy. This was the kind of technology that humanity was on the verge of understanding, like telepathy, ley lines, telluric currents, the Akashic records, whatever, like all this, like this hippie stuff. A lot of it was like Eastern Orientalist stuff, like filtered through the hippies and through the Timothy Leary or whoever the very extremely high, extremely stoned, the Carlos Castaneda kind of school of like thought. So
Philosophicals.
well, yeah, and that was seen as kind of like and this is also the era of like the CIA feeding people with LSD and trying to get them to do remote viewing or whatever, so MK Ultra and all that. So all of this was seen as kind of semi-technological, right? It was a kind of science fiction. It was something that was supposed to be within grasp. I think Ley Lines was one of that at one point. I think like it was something that like many people who we would today probably not consider serious thinkers, but at the time were considered serious. Definitely thought of as, oh, like you should totally like tapping into the ley lines is a real and important thing that we should be doing because it has like actual scientific meaning in some sense. So, and I think that fed a lot of horror and fantasy fiction in that in those decades and also afterwards because just such a fruitful terrain for imaginative storytelling.
It's interesting because, I mean, you mentioned the Akashic Record, which you use a lot in Rexfall.
In Rick's fall, yes.
So there is also, I think, a lot of links between the way you describe your story as being linked to a certain, I would say, family line through reincarnation, and the importance of that spot in Ghost Watch that is also very grounded. Do you think that I wouldn't say that you've been inspired, but do you see some resonances between your way of presenting the haunting or the cycle of reincarnations in your novel and taking place?
The way that I present reincarnation in Wakesfall is explicitly to separate it from family lines, right? From like descent by blood. What I'm trying to say in Wakesfall is that these resonances that do exist in time and across generations are about intention and commitment and sometimes just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And in that sense, I think there is a very clear resonance with Ghost Watch. I don't think I got it from Ghost Watch, but clearly, like it is, I think, but there is a resonance there because the same kind of idea, right? Like this family, these kids are not descended from Tunstall or from Mother Seddon. They have nothing to do with any of those people except that they happen to live there. And they happen to live there through whatever, the through bureaucracy, really, no other reason. So I think the idea that people can get caught up in these generational or these historic traumas by accident as much as intention, more than through descent, is what makes it feel very very modern in that sense because it's a movement away from this very gothic obsession with inheritance and descent, right? So this is like a modern Gothic where you're saying, no, actually, it could be anyone. You just happen to walk into this patch of haunted land, and now it's your problem.
Yeah, it's not blood, it's about location.
This might be a nice time to transition to ask you what you're currently working on, and if you could tell our listeners about what we might expect from you in the coming months, years, etc.
Well, I am working on what I hope will be my third novel. It will not be coming out next year because it's a bit too late in the season for that. So, but I'm hoping for 2026. It will be, I think, as most of my both my books have been so far, kind of mixed genre story. I haven't really got the details worked out yet. But one of the things that I do in all my work is kind of mix up the territories of fantasy, horror, and science fiction in ways that pretty much everyone finds, well, confusing, but sometimes confusing in a good way, which is, So, yes, the third book will be something on those lines, and it will be out, I don't know, but probably the summer of 2026. Next year, I will, th there will be, the UK edition and the French edition, I believe, of Rake's Fall. The French edition of Saint of Bright Doors came out just like a couple of months ago. And there should be a few other translations coming out next year as well. So next year is for me, I'm just keeping my head down and writing while various translations and editions continue to come out. And hopefully by the following year, I'll have something new to announce.
Fantastic. Congratulations on Rick's Fall, because I haven't read it yet because I live with Frank and
Okay.
he's been hogging the book and telling me how wonderful it is, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
I think it's a real masterpiece. I mean, I really like this set of bright doors too. I don't mean this as a criticism, but I think it is more conventional in storytelling, much closer to what people expect of a traditional novel. But I think that Rex Fall is taking things to a whole other level, and I really, really thought it was experimental and poetic and really a masterpiece, in my opinion.
Thank you so much.
Yesterday,
And
he.
I hope you both get a chance to read
Thank you.
it. No, I'm hiding it.
Yesterday, he told me that it is his favorite book that he's read this year. So that's a really great
Wow.
recommendation, and I'm looking.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having joined us today on this episode of After Images. It was wonderful to hear your thoughts and your interest in Ghostwatch. We hope that your third novel will be a smashing success. And well, thank you again. It was wonderful to spend this time with you today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. I had a great time. I hope I made sense.
Course, yes.
We hope we made sense also in our question.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I feel like Ghostwatch is something that we could discuss for hours because there's so much to dig
There
into.
is so much.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.